Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, December 11th, 2021, weekend edition. Section A. Hope on the horizon for behavioral health care. It is difficult to put into words the challenges America has faced over the last 2 years. Every sector has been altered forever. Healthcare, education, housing, the economy, and workforce have undergone generational transformation. A byproduct of these challenges is the impact on mental health for citizens around the world, and nowhere is that more apparent than in our own backyard. According to Mental Health America's 2021 State of Mental Health, Texas ranks 50th out of 51 states and the District of Columbia in access to mental health care. The ability to access these services is particularly strained in more rural parts of the state, like the Permian Basin. An in-depth regional healthcare assessment launched by the Permian Strategic Partnership earlier this year confirmed this trend, identifying that access to behavioral health services, compounded by a shortage of specialists such as psychiatrists, is one of the more urgent healthcare needs in our region. Many residents across our communities must travel an hour or more to receive care from an inpatient hospital, and more than a quarter of Midland-Odessa residents leave the area to receive health care. The need for increased access to behavioral health services, including crisis stabilization, counseling, community education, and residency services, has never been more important. We know there is hope on the horizon. Recently, we received confirmation of a $40 million appropriation in Texas Senate Bill 8 for a regional behavioral health care facility in the Permian Basin. This funding may lay the groundwork for the community to launch a viable effort to raise additional dollars needed to complete the facility, to be jointly operated by the Midland and Ector County Hospital Districts. An accomplishment like this does not happen overnight. It takes collaboration, determination, and extensive research and extensive education efforts to move forward. Taking what we learned from the initial phase of the PSP's healthcare assessment and in partnership with Texas Tech University System, the University of Texas System, and the Scarborough Foundation, our local leaders took action. We commend the initiative of our healthcare leaders, Russell Myers and Russell Tippin, who submitted a joint letter to Representative Tom Craddock and Representative Brooks Landgraf, outlining the need for and requesting $87 million in funding for a regional behavioral health facility. We appreciate Craddock and Landgraf for recognizing the opportunity to capitalize on pass-through funds from the Federal American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, and congratulate them on securing support for an impactful $40 million appropriation in the Texas House version of the bill. The data derived from the Permian Basin Healthcare Assessment helped education efforts with key leaders, such as Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. Now, Texas Senate Bill 8 awaits the governor's signature after working its way through Texas's third special legislative session. We're grateful for the attention to this project from leadership in the House and Senate. Efforts to improve access to health care services in the Permian cannot stop here. In the last year, the Permian Strategic Partnership has announced funding support to establish Permian Basin counseling and guidance, and is eager to expand its service area. We have also entered partnerships with Texas Tech University and Odessa College to bolster physician programs to help attract and retain healthcare professionals and build a sustainable workforce and economic foundation for local healthcare systems. We continue to explore other collaborative initiatives that will make it possible to improve access to all kinds of high-quality healthcare services right here in the Permian. There is still much work to make the behavioral health project a reality, and this funding appropriation is a huge step forward in moving from plans to reality. As we celebrate the success in securing this financial support, we must also recognize and applaud our communities and leaders for working collectively for the mutual benefit of our region. Here in the Permian Basin, we know the sky is the limit, and transformative things happen when we think big and pursue change together. We can learn from this experience as we continue to address the pressing needs of the region. Pfluger Forms Effort to Stop Ban by Mella McEwen. Reports that the Biden administration is considering reinstating a ban on U.S. crude oil exports had a group of U.S. representatives so concerned they wrote the president urging against the reinstatement. "I'm very concerned," said Representative Pfluger, the San Angelo rep who represents Midland as part of District 11. He told the Reporter-Telegram in an interview that concern over the reinstatement was so great that the letter he and his bipartisan group of colleagues wrote was brought up to Press Secretary Jen Psaki. He called reinstating the export ban a massive threat that has Democratic colleagues sharing his concern. In the letter, which he and Representative Henry Cuellar led, they cited a number of negative consequences should the ban be reinstated. Restrict the global supply of oil, thereby putting upward pressure on global prices and potentially straining international relationships. Limit access to a global marketplace, thus discouraging new domestic production, restricting supply, and exacerbating future consumer costs for gasoline, natural gas, and electricity. Create an imbalance between refining capacity and domestic production, introducing costly inefficiency in the production of gasoline, and pose serious threats to thousands of jobs, reversing an important bipartisan policy agreement during the Obama administration. Not only would the 10 million direct and indirect oil gas jobs nationwide and the $2 million direct and indirect oil and gas jobs statewide be affected, Pfluger said, but all Americans would be affected by losing access to affordable energy. Rather than ban exports or release even more oil from the nation's strategic petroleum reserve to drive energy costs down, what we need to do is unleash the incredible innovation the Permian Basin is capable of. Pfluger also wrote a letter to Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm and Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo, who, after becoming concerned about comments Secretary Granholm had made about reinstating an export ban. The letter, he said, seeks answers on what their intentions are on the subject. In the letter, the two secretaries are asked to supply answers to the following questions. What would be the impact on the U.S. economy in terms of lost GDP and lost jobs should this moratorium be reinstated? What will the aggregate effect of decreased U.S. oil exports have on net global carbon emissions? Are U.S. refiners currently able to feasibly process U.S.-produced crude oil that would no longer be exported? Have you consulted with the National Security Council to determine the national security implications of being more dependent on OPEC Plus countries? Within 24 hours of launching the letter, Pfluger said 61 Republican representatives, an estimated 25% of the party's members of Congress, have signed the letter. He told the Reporter-Telegram that representatives of energy companies and trade associations had been in the nation's capital to help get that message out. He listed the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers as one association assisting with those efforts. Reimposing a crude oil export ban is a reckless policy that will reduce energy supplies at home and condemn America's allies to energy poverty and a growing dependence on Russia, says Jason Moglen, the alliance president, told the Reporter-Telegram. Alliance members are very happy to see Congressman Pfluger two letters to the administration on this, particularly in reaching across the aisle to get Texas congressmen in the president's party to also champion American-produced energy over foreign imports. President Biden should know a call to Midland will actually be answered to meet U.S. and our allies' energy demands this winter and beyond. While Pfluger is raising these concerns with the secretaries and the president, he said he's also leading an effort to build bipartisan support for continued exports, raising awareness among Democrats as to how devastating the moratorium could be. people of the 11th District have heard me say this before. But energy security is national security. That is why he coined the phrase Midland over Moscow, urging the administration to consider energy security as part of national security. Look at Ukraine and how vulnerable it is. They're facing an invasion threat from Russia, he said. One reason Ukraine is so vulnerable is it's beholden to Russia for its energy. It's hard to defend yourself when you're beholden to someone else's for energy. The Permian Basin is the most prolific oil and gas producing basin in the world, and he was sent to Congress to defend it, he said. A proposed reinstatement of the export ban is an assault and a threat to the region, and I will fight back and educate people on its importance. A look at decades of change to Southeast Midland schools by Stuart Doreen. During the conversation about a move of the Young Women's Leadership Academy to the facility currently home to Washington STEM Academy, there have been complaints that Midland ISD keeps taking away neighborhood schools. Though it was agreed to that Washington STEM wasn't a neighborhood school, there are still some Midlanders not happy about elementary schools on the east and south sides turned into magnets or choice schools. However, the history of changes made to elementary campuses like Washington STEM, Carver Center, and Pease Elementary shows the district was not attempting to change conditions to specific neighborhoods, but deal with separate issues with the U.S. Department of Justice and Texas Education Agency. In this article, the Reporter-Telegram will attempt to provide context to the changes to elementary schools in East and Southeast Midland, specifically Washington STEM, Pease Communications and Technology Academy, and Carver Center. Some in Midland may remember the court case, the United States of America versus the Midland Independent School District and its superintendent, James H. Maley, in 1971. It stated that Midland ISD's elementary schools were not desegregated. Consequently, the Western District of Texas ordered MISD to implement an elementary cluster system and its accompanying busing component. In 1999, Midland ISD filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit and regain its unitary status as a school district. The lawsuit involved a plaintiff, the USA, and interveners, Dr. Viola Coleman et al., and the defendant, MISD. After it was established that the district complied with the court's busing order, MISD was then required to take steps over the next 3 years to remove any remaining vestiges of past discrimination, according to the school district and settlement order. One of the six provisions of the settlement agreement dealt with elementary student assignment. Part B of that provision stated MISD shall identify two racially identifiable minority elementary schools to be converted to dedicated magnet elementary schools. If MISD implemented a gifted and talented, or GT, school, it was then obligated to implement a total of three magnet schools, and the GT magnet was to be designated as a racially identifiable minority elementary school or Carver Cultural Center. That was responsible for the birth of Carver Center for gifted and talented students, northeast of the intersection of Carver Street and Wall Street, of Washington STEM Academy, southwest of Wall Street and Tilden Street, and of Pease Communication and Technology Academy, northwest of Benton Street and Scarborough Drive. Those schools were expected to be racially identifiable with an Anglo student enrollment percentage greater than 15% below the district-wide Anglo elementary school enrollment percentage. In 2001, MISD filed a motion to dismiss and established full compliance with the agreement and its constitutional obligations. The Department of Justice agreed. The judge presiding found the district had complied with the agreement, dismissed the lawsuit, and MISD regained its unitary status. James Fuller, the former representative for District 1, stated this week that the interveners at the time believed that segregation in Midland was alive and that was reflected in the school system at that time. He called the initiative to move to magnet schools courageous, as it went against the grain of practices in education at the time. He talked about the opportunities created and the experiences offered to students in a then-segregated school system. Fuller acknowledged that even then there were some who stated magnet schools destroyed neighborhoods, but he stated the schools provided exposure to programs students had not experienced before. Crockett Elementary and Travis Elementary experienced change because of the academic and performance issues and the threat of Texas Education Agency intervention. In March 2017, Crockett Elementary in East Midland was headed for its seventh straight failing year, according to the TEA. At that time, the Midland ISD Board voted to close the school to students that were at the school at the time. The district then provided new leadership, a new staff, a new name, General Tommy Franks Elementary, and a new student body, students from the growing State Highway 349 corridor area. Students at Crockett were sent to other schools in the immediate area. The board's other option was allowing the TEA to take the school over. In 2019, Travis Elementary avoided having to ship its students to different campuses when MISD leaders decided to partner with IDEA Public Schools to create IDEA Travis. At the time, Travis Elementary had one of the longest failing streaks in the state, but House Bill 4205 gave the district an option not available 2 years earlier. IDEA Travis opened for the 2021 school year. Crude prices post biggest weekly gains since August, by Mella McEwen. Commodity prices are recovering from their steep drop as concerns ease over the Omicron variant of the COVID virus. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Exchange rose 4 of 5 trading days, starting the week at 323 and gaining or shaking off a 142 drop Thursday to post 8.2% increase for the week. That's the biggest gain since August. WTI rose 73 cents to close at 71.67 Friday. The posted price ended up the week at 68.15. Natural gas price spent the week below the $4 range after Monday's 47 cent drop, but prices managed to rise 3 of 5 trading days and ending the week at 3.925 per MCF. This was a positive week for the Black Friday Omicron drop, and we continue to see positive signs in terms of global demand recovery, Jason Moglen, president of the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers, told the Reporter-Telegram. Our biggest fear is overreaction from governments imposing trade restrictions or locking down economies. It's a testament to our producers and the pro-business, pro-consumer regulatory environment that Texas has led the U.S. recovery in oil and natural gas production. Concerns about the Omicron variant and its impact on global oil demand did prompt the U.S. Energy Information Administration to lower its crude oil price forecast. In its December short-term energy outlook, the agency lowered its price for Brent, the global benchmark, from $78 as forecast in the November outlook to $73 a barrel in the first quarter. WTI, the U.S. benchmark, typically trades about $5 lower, putting it at around $68 a barrel. The agency also significantly reduced its expected global crude inventory drawdowns from December to February to an average of 170,000 barrels per day. Annual inventory buildups, which the EIA said will put downward pressure on oil prices next year, is forecast to be 480,000 barrels a day next year. The EIA said global oil production will rise by 5%, 5 million barrels a day, to 101 million barrels next year, with non-OPEC production rising 3 million barrels, led by the U.S., Russia, and to a lesser extent, Brazil. U.S. petroleum production is forecast to rise by 1.3 million barrels a day to 20 million barrels a day in 2022. Rig count increases for sixth time in 7 weeks, by Mella McEwen. Rig activity gained some momentum despite the recent swoon in commodity prices. oilfield services firm Baker Hughes said Friday the U.S. rig count rose by 7 to 576. It was the sixth increase in 7 weeks and is 238 more rigs than at work nationally last December. There were 471 rigs seeking crude, up 4 for the week, and 213 more than last year. There were 105 rigs drilling for natural gas, up 3 for the week. The Permian Basin, which continues to account for about half the nation's drilling rigs, added 3 rigs at work in the basin, more than the 168 counted last year. Lee County, New Mexico, continues to be the most active county in the Permian Basin. Midland County followed with 29 rigs, down 1. Barbara Lanier Holmes passed away on December 7th at Pinecrest Retirement Community. Memorial services will be held Tuesday, December 14th at 11:30 a.m. at Henderson Chapel, First United Methodist Church of Lufkin. Interment will be prior to the services at 9:30 in Jasper City Cemetery. Carol Patricia Franks passed away on December 8th. Visitation will be at the Brownfield Funeral Home on Monday, December 13th from 6 to 8, with funeral service on Tuesday, December 14th at 10. Please join us after the service for a memorial lunch and reception at 1711 East Repto Street in Brownfield. Dorothy Jean Mason of Midland passed away on Saturday, November 20th. Family graveside rites will be conducted on a date to be announced, with burial at Fairview Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home. Gregorio Jose Villanueva passed away on December 6th. Visitation will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. on Saturday, December 11th at Kimball Funeral Home in Junction. Graveside services and burial will be at 1 p.m. on Sunday, December 12th at Junction City Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Kimball Funeral Home. Paula Powers Cahoon passed away on Wednesday, December 8th. A memorial service will be held at First Presbyterian Church on Thursday, December 16th at 2 p.m. Renee Chesnier Deshane Cowles passed away on December 8th. Viewing will be 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Monday, December 13th at Willowbrook Funeral Home in Midland. Family will receive friends on Monday, December 13th from 5 to 8. Graveside services will be at 11 on Tuesday, December 14th at Rest Haven Memorial Park in Midland. Arrangements are entrusted to Willowbrook Funeral Home in Midland. Oscar M. Escontrias passed away Monday, December 4th. Visitation will be Tuesday, December 7th at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Ruth Ann Dunavant passed away on Monday, December 6th. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. on December 18th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Odessa American for Saturday, December 11th. Polvin, Guilty of Capital Murder by Royal McGregor. After about an hour of deliberation, an Ector County jury found Fabian Polvin guilty of gunning down his wife and her friend at an Odessa car wash in 2019. The Ector County jury began its deliberations at 10:48 a.m. Friday and returned to District Judge Justin Lowe's 161st courtroom at around 11:49 a.m. with a guilty verdict for capital murder, a first-degree felony. Polvin was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole after he was found guilty of shooting 2 people to death back in November 2019, including 36-year-old Joseph Granado and his wife, Tiffany Nicole Polvin. Kevin Schultz and Bill Prasher prosecuted the case, while Joe Spencer and Felix Valenzuela represented Fabian Pulvin. After the jury was released by Judge Lowe, impact statements were read by members of Granados and Tiffany Pulvin's family members. Linda Hinojos, the cousin of Tiffany Pulvin, stared at Fabian Pulvin while she spoke to him, and at one point in time she mentioned, "You can't even look at me." And Fabian Pulvin responded with, "I'm sorry." Hinojos also claimed that Fabian Pulvin had promised to her that he wasn't going to abuse Tiffany Pulvin anymore. Yet she continued to say that Fabian Pulvin hunted my cousin down like an animal. Hinojos told Fabian Pulvin that he is getting off easy. She continued to explain that Granado and Tiffany Pulvin were sentenced to death by Fabian Pulvin's hands. Hinojos said, "Lucky you aren't receiving the same sentence." Joe Granado, the father of Joseph Granado, spoke and told Fabian Pulvin that he's going to have to face the music. Joe Granado also told Fabian Pulvin what he did was an evil and cowardly act, and then called Fabian Pulvin a coward. Joe Granado also spoke about how his son was a great listener and that he would listen to anyone regardless of ethnicity, social status, or education level. He also said that if Fabian Pulvin would have spoken to his son, that this would have never happened. However, Joe Granado said Fabian Pulvin has destroyed lives forever because of his greed, ego, and selfishness. Friday's trial opened with closing statements from the prosecution and defense. Prysher opened where he spoke to the jury about Fabian Pulvin killing Joseph Granado, but abusing Tiffany Pulvin. Granado was shot twice, while Pulvin was shot at least 8 times. Valenzuela opened for the defense's closing arguments, where he explained the mental health experts that were called to the stand on Thursday were the most important part, as Fabian Pulvin had pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. Throughout his closing arguments, Valenzuela spoke about the testimony given by Dr. James Shute, who was called by the defense, and Dr. Roddy Strobel, who was appointed by the court. Spencer spoke for the defense's final 10 minutes of closing arguments, where he continued to talk about the differences between Shute and Strobel. During the rebuttal, Schultz spoke to the jury, and he said the defense had filed for insanity until late July, after Shute had met Fabian Pulvin on 4 separate occasions. Schultz told the jury in his final words that Tiffany Pulvin and Joseph Granado each deserve justice. Emerald Forest Decks the Houses by Michael Bauer. Every December, all of Emerald Forest transforms into a winter wonderland. For about a decade now, the area, including Shiloh Road, is filled with house after house that puts up holiday displays that dazzles everyone from all over the area and draws visitors every season. This year, that tradition has continued. Guests made their way to Shiloh Road and all other parts of Emerald Forest Thursday night and were awestruck by the displays of the lights and decorations. The Junior League of Odessa was on hand to give carriage rides as part of a fundraiser. Each night during the holiday season, people will walk up and down the streets in Emerald Forest and marvel at the Christmas lights from each house. Permian High School AP Government and Politics teacher Bob Brescia is one of the many people that lives in the Emerald Forest subdivision that participates in the holiday-themed decorations. For him and his neighbors, the planning starts as early as the day after Christmas. "I can't speak for all the neighbors, but in terms of planning and Christmas, because this is just like any other Christmas operation, the planning starts on December 26th, the day after Christmas," Brescia said. "That's when the planning for the next year, as far as putting things together, that's a year-long exercise for me, and that's an exercise for the neighbors themselves. But I would say towards the summertime is when people start thinking about the holidays coming up. That's when they start planning for Halloween and Christmas and to begin to make things. They all do a wonderful job at it." Brescia has lived in Odessa for 8 years. He spent the first 5 years at UTPB before moving over to K-12 education. Brescia said that every Christmas season is different as far as decorations go. "Every year we plan something different," Brescia said. "One year I had a Christmas train in the front yard. It was a pretty nice train. Another year we had an oil derrick, and the lights made it look like oil was coming out of the well." Brescia said he has also a windmill and a Santa Claus that he has fitted with LED strip lighting as well as other characters. "I have one character that blows a horn. I outfitted him with LED strip lights. I called him Horatio Hornblower. I give everyone a name. They're named Tex, Tessa, and the two gingerbread cookie carolers. They are gingerbread cookie singers, and all four are LED lights, where their arms and legs move." Brescia was able to make his characters' mouths move to the music to look like they're singing, and he didn't stop there. "I got dangerous and went into two very large RGB matrices, and those are driven by computers and computer software to make it all look synchronized," Brescia said. Brescia uses a character animator to make the mouths move properly to what's being said, then do a rear projection onto a window. "One of the large rooms we have has a large window that faces the street, and I do a projection and all kinds of imagery plays on that window as the songs are playing. You can hear the songs outside. I also have a radio transmitting capability. So I put down there, tune your car to 87.9 FM to hear the shows. You can hear it on the radio. That becomes useful on days when it's really cold. People come by when it's really cold." Needless to say, he gets a lot of compliments from people who pass by. It's not just Odessans that stop by either, as Midlanders will come over. Brescia will often play Santa Claus as well. "The other day, a few people came over and introduced themselves. I'd go out and meet the people. I also dress up as Santa. The little kids would come around and they say, 'Are you the real Santa?' And I tell them I'm Santa's helper. I want to maintain the magic for the kids." There are no set themes for the entire neighborhood, as each house will do something different with decorations. One house on Sapphire Street does a dinosaur theme with the front yard decked out with dinosaur inflatable displays. Others will have manger in the front with signs reading Joy and Believe lit up. Another residence in the area, located on Shiloh Road, is decorated with holiday lights and themed displays from Disney's movie Frozen. Judge Sarah Kate Billingsley is another resident in the Emerald Forest subdivision. This year, she chose to go with a Grinch-themed Christmas for her front yard, which includes a Whoville. In the past, Billingsley said her Christmas decorations would be mostly inside the house. But this is the first time she's done outside decorations, and it won't be the last either. "This house has such a great front yard that we went crazy for Halloween and crazy for Christmas," Billingsley said. "I think I want to do Valentine's Day and Easter. I want to do all the holidays now." She's also received plenty of compliments from people who pass by. "Everyone has been so kind," Billingsley said. "They've said the nicest things. COVID has been really tough, so it's nice to sit outside and have people drive by and say nice things, or hop out of their cars and take photos of my Who House or the Grinch, and that's pretty fun." A lot of her decorations are handmade. The cotton candies, the Whoville post office is handmade, and the Who House is handmade, Billingsley said. "It takes a while. Everything is sculpted out of styrofoam and painted on. It takes a while. I don't know how many hours, but it's my therapy. Sometimes I'll have a hard day on the bench and then go out and paint something. I used to cook, and now I paint, apparently. It's all worth it to see everyone's expressions when they come by." "I have a job where people don't smile," Billingsley said. "You don't come to court because you're happy, and I don't get to see many smiles. My favorite part is seeing unadulterated joy on the faces of kiddos and adults alike. How can you not be happy listening to Christmas music, drinking hot chocolate, and looking at all the amazing houses up and down the street? Every house decorates, which I think is so cool, because everyone is into the Christmas spirit, and it makes everyone happy. I think the world needs more of that." Longtime Odessan Johnny Lassiter, who is retired, is another resident over at Shiloh Road, who also participates in decorations. I guess when we moved into the house here, it had only been about half populated and was a bunch of vacant lots, Lassiter said, who's lived in the area for 26 years now and has lived in Odessa for 44 years. There were a few things out, and then as more and more people moved in, it grew, and before long it became the Christmas street of Odessa. Lassiter will put lights on the houses and decorate the trees outside as well as wrap the trunks. What we've done as far as up in the trees themselves, we've gotten these big balls from Hobby Lobby and I wrap them up in lights. One tree will have different colored lights, like red, blues, and greens. I have some Santa Claus and reindeer out in the front yard. They're about 25 years old. They've been redone, and every now and then I'll repaint them and relight them every once in a while. Lassiter says he does most of it by himself as far as setting everything up, with the exception of the lights on the roof. I do everything on my own around the house except on the roof, Lassiter said. My wife decided that a 75-year-old didn't need to be on the roof. I get someone else to do that, but everything else we do. Some people will have some people come in and do it for them. For Lassiter, the decorating starts right after Halloween. The pressure is on after Halloween, Lassiter said. That's when we start decorating heavily. I guess what I enjoy is when people come by. We have a big 100-pound Labradoodle dog, and we'll go out every night so he can visit with people. It's neat. In addition to the cars driving by, there are a bunch of people coming out and walking around. Like most other residents on Shiloh Road, Lassiter and his wife, Sandra, meet new people every year. You get to meet a lot of people that way. They enjoy it, especially when they have little kids. It's a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun. Hubbub arises over GOP chairmanship by Bob Campbell. Some local Republicans say the Ector County GOP leadership only wants to follow the rules that keep the current leadership in place. Richard Pierce, a 63-year-old Odessa plumber who ran for the city council 2 years ago, wants to seek the chairmanship of the Ector County Republican Party, but his bid has been thwarted by a political technicality, and he is unhappy about it. With the filing deadline for getting into the March 1st primary looming Monday, Richard Pierce said Thursday that he had thought we would have a free and open election, but it doesn't look like it unless somebody changes their mind. Having run for the Odessa City Council in 2020 and settling his runoff with Councilman Tom Sprawls with a coin flip and losing, Pierce said he needed the support of the only two GOP precinct chairmen who had been elected to their posts, but only Judy Calloway backed him. Stringently criticizing current party chair Tisha Crowe for not welcoming a challenge, Pierce said the only other elected precinct chairman, Aubrey Mayberry, didn't support him and had not responded to his entreaties. I'm disappointed because I would like to get on the ballot, he said. Only 19 of the county's 40 voting precincts have chairmen, Crowe said Thursday afternoon, adding that she had not appointed any precinct leaders, but that the county GOP executive committee had appointed them, and they were subsequently elected in the primaries. Odessa Ronnie Lewis challenges that assertion and says precinct chairs are only on the ballot if opposed, and that Crowe is not being honest about her appointments to the precinct chairs. Lewis also said the Secretary of State's website shows only Democrat precinct chairs registered, and no Ector County Republicans registered as precinct chairs. Lewis said he presumes that is because Crowe hasn't filed the paperwork. So they want to follow certain rules, but only the ones that keep her in power, Lewis said. Crowe said the state legislature passed a law in the last session that requires at least two precinct chairmen or 10% of the committee to sign a petition allowing a candidate to run for the county chairmanship. Crowe said the law was passed because a candidate had been elected, Travis County GOP chair, whom none of that executive committee knew or wanted. This just came up, and only one precinct chair, Judy Calloway, supported Richard, although Judy was one of those who signed a pledge for me when we had our last board meeting on November 11th, Crow said. Mayor Javier Hovan could sign for Richard, but the mayor has said he will not sign for anyone. She said she is not averse to competition, but the executive committee does not want anyone else for a leader. Efforts to reach Calloway were unsuccessful. Lewis, a 66-year-old longtime Odessan and Republican, was also critical of Crow's leadership. "I don't like what she has been doing over the years, appointing precinct chairs when someone dropped out or left," Lewis said. "She runs it with an iron fist and expects complete loyalty. I heard they all had to sign an oath to be loyal to her. She has about a half dozen members who make these decisions." Lewis said he supports Pierce's right to run and that he would run himself if the way were cleared. 80% of the Ector County Republican Women's Club wants another candidate, but they've got us blocked, said Lewis. "It's not right, and they know it's not right." Another disgruntled Republican, Tim Edgman, said an executive committee member had told Pierce that the committee was happy with Crow and didn't want anyone else. "They're all hesitant, but I believe Richard should be allowed to run," Edgman said. "Tisha should allow it." Obituaries from the Odessa American for Saturday. On Sunday, December 5th, Jimmy Dean Jones, Jr., age 45, of Odessa, left this earth and moved on to a better place with his angel wings. Jimmy Dean came into this world on May 4, 1976, in Odessa, to parents Jimmy Jones and Regina McGee Jones. Left behind to cherish his memories are his parents, his sister Alicia Hall of Odessa, his children Amber Lujan and her husband Marty of Amarillo, Lemoyne Harris and Kevin, Chelsea Jones and Nico, Zachary Jones and Bree, Haley Jones, Ashton Jones, Caden Jones, and Brooklyn Jones, all of Odessa. Jimmy has 6 grandkids, also numerous aunts, uncles, cousins, and tons of friends. Jimmy was preceded in death by his maternal grandparents, Georgia Evelyn Heath and Jack McGee, his paternal grandparents, Howard R. Jones and Wanda Louise Cullison. Visitation will be held at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home on Sunday, December 12th. Services will be at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home Monday, December 13th at 10 a.m. Burial will follow at American Heritage Cemetery. Sergio Moriel, Jr., 31, of Dallas, passed away Sunday, December 5th in Dallas. A funeral service will be held on Monday, December 13th at 11 a.m., at Elmwood Funeral Home Chapel in Abilene. Interment will follow at Elmwood Memorial Park. Sergio was born on May 12, 1990 in Dallas to Sergio Moriel Sr. and Anne Marie Garza Moriel. Sergio is survived by his parents, sisters Antoinette Moriel and Brianna Moriel, grandparents Ignacio and Rosario Moriel, and Adina Carrillo, aunts, uncles, and nieces. Hello, this is Cindy, reading from the Odessa American for Sunday, December 12th. Andrews Making Its Way After Tragic Wreck by Ruth Campbell. In the aftermath of the accident involving 3 band buses from Andrews ISD, Superintendent Bobby Azam said the outpouring of support has been incredible, but at the same time, the district is realizing things will never go back to the way they were before. The Texas Department of Public Safety and National Transportation Safety Board are investigating. The summary from the NTSB website said the accident occurred about 4:02 p.m., November 19th, in the eastbound lanes of Interstate 20 near Big Spring. A Ford F-350 traveling the wrong way, westbound, in the eastbound lanes near mile marker 179, struck a 2005 MCI motor coach nearly head-on. Nathan Paul Hale, 59, of Midland, the driver of the F-350, was killed, and the pickup truck was destroyed by a post-crash fire. The 2005 motor coach was the lead vehicle in a caravan of three buses owned and operated by Andrews Independent School District. The motor coach was transporting 25 high school student band members and three adults, including the driver, to a high school football game in Sweetwater. The motor coach driver, Mark Boswell, 69, and band director, Darren Johns, 53, were killed. Karen Johns, Darren Johns' wife, and 13 students sustained injuries and were transported to local hospitals. 11 students were uninjured. A second motor coach was struck by the F-350 with minor damage. The third motor coach in the caravan was not involved in the crash. In the crash vicinity, I-20 consisted of two travel lanes in both the east and westbound directions, separated by a median. Azam said the wreck happened just before Thanksgiving break, and the district had counselors come in, but other districts also provided support. There have been benefits, a show of support from area bands, and ongoing fund drives for the band. Students were able to come in if they felt like they needed to over that weekend and through the holiday. There were some that took advantage, Azam said. We had hotlines available. We knew, though, that through the break that Friday was going to be the first funeral for the driver, and then the following Monday was the band director's funeral. We were building to those 2 days because we knew those days were going to be tough, he said. The next Tuesday was also difficult because it was the first day back to school after the wreck. We've got over 1,200 kids in the high school, and not every kid was intimately affected by this, but a lot of them were, Azam said. Students, especially those in band, were able to meet with counselors and support staff in the auditorium instead of going to class. Lubbock ISD offered up a crisis team and therapy dogs, which worked out well. I got to watch it, and I'll tell you it was phenomenal, Azam said. He said students who were reluctant to open up could talk to the dogs with the counselors listening in. The counselors were trained to, when they saw the kids interact with a dog, to ask questions at the right time, Azam said. They've offered that service again. We probably will take them up on it in the future, he added. From that point, they have taken things day by day. We'll never really get back to normal. It's really never going to be normal. You can't fill those shoes, Azam said. You can't take the place of the men who died. Azam said the students are resilient, and they've been through a lot over the past couple of years with COVID, Snowvid, and the wreck. They've had a run of pretty major events, but I guess, really, the kids are in a good spot. They're in good spirits. We're having to take some things slow. Some kids are not really ready to go back into the band hall. Some kids are. You've got two dynamics. You've got, I call them, the rip the band-aid off kids. They're the ones that just let go, jump right back in the middle of it right now. You've got others that aren't really ready. It's been really great, the outpouring of support. I've said it all along, this is West Texas. This is what we do out here. That's how people are, he added. In a December 7th interview, he noted that people they didn't even know helped out at the accident scene, and while the accident was horrific and tragic, it brought people together. There were two ladies, and I don't know who they are, I'll never forget their faces, but they were two ladies that showed up that were from Monahan's. They were traveling to their game. They got Monahan's Lobo shirts. They're helping to calm our kids. I can't keep up with everybody who has contributed to helping. Countless phone calls and emails have been incredible, Azam said. He said the students that were injured are faring well, and Karen Johns, a teacher at Underwood, is recovering. Asked if the district is considering handling travel differently as a result of the wreck, Azam said there hasn't been much they've thought of to change except letting everyone know who is on each bus. He added that district personnel did a really good job and had all the emergency contacts. You know, if the wreck had happened, let's say on the Big Spring Highway, which just two lanes and you're passing, we might go, all right, no more travel on those roads. Or if the bus had been coming back at 2 a.m, we could say, no more late night travel. With this was 4 p.m, 4:30 p.m. We're on an interstate highway. We're not expecting a wrong way driver. There probably will be something that we think of, but we've traveled since then. We've had kids go to things, and we tried to allow for plenty of time, and we made sure that our drivers are not overdriven. But we are already doing those things, so honestly, there's really not much else that we can think of from this that we're like, oh, we can never do that again. It was just a freak thing. He said they had been on State Highway 176 before getting on I-20. You go over it, and that's where actually my vehicle caught up to bus number 3. So then you're on the access road for not very far at all, and you get on the interstate, Azam said. Investigators checked with hotels and trucking companies that have dash cameras, among other places, he said. I think they've checked everything. I think they were able to find out all the details of the accident. We do know that there were a couple of 911 calls reporting the guy driving the wrong way, which tells you that people saw it. I don't know how long, how far he was driving the wrong way, Azam said. Some of the instruments in the first bus were destroyed, but those on the other two were fine. You'd have a horn that the case would look like it had been run over by a tractor and the horn was fine. Then you'd have another case. This is what's fascinating about accidents. Another case would be all locked up and perfect, and the horn is beat to smithereens. It makes no sense, Azam said. The district has been working with in-tune music and sound on the rented instruments. Those who had their own personal instruments will have them replaced by the district or insurance. Of course, some of the instruments that are ours will replace. Insurance will help, but if they don't, we've had lots of generous donations of people wanting to help, he said. All the clothing that was left on the buses was gathered up. All the leather jackets we took to the dry cleaners for them. It's kind of a little thing, but it's the least we could do, Azam said. He added that it's by the grace of God that the bus didn't flip over or roll, because had that happened, it would have been just catastrophically worse, Azam said. The band has 150 members and about 120 march, and pretty much all of them went on that trip. Azam said there were about 30 students on the first bus. He said they have racked their brains trying to figure out what else they can do. You can't not travel. You've got to travel to do things. But at the same time, you don't want to go through that again, so you kind of just try to figure out how you do it safely. You would think the interstate is a safer road than just two lanes. That was a tough call. And I can't imagine, probably the only thing worse than coming up on a bus would be coming up on your own family. But our people that showed up, that helped, did a great job, he said. With social media, everything travels so fast that they were getting messages asking whether the news about the wreck was true while they were still sorting out things at the scene. In defense of them, they didn't realize we were on the scene. They didn't realize we pulled up to it, so they might have thought we were at home or already at the game or something. Hey, is this true? Asked whether the district is looking at a new band director, Azam said that question is difficult. Our assistant directors have stepped in. They're doing a fantastic job of keeping things going, he added. Obituaries and death notices from the Odessa American for Sunday. Betty Eloise Miller Lane, 92, passed away at her residence into the waiting arms of loved ones December 6th. Betty was born March 7th, 1929, to Claude and Annie Gwynn Miller in Breckenridge, Texas. She is preceded in death by her loving husband, Leland, a son, Larry Lane, a grandson, Doug Lane, a son-in-law, John Campbell, and 4 siblings, Anne Connolly, Jean Miller, James Miller, and Mickey Fletcher. She is survived by a daughter, Nancy Campbell, daughter-in-law, Becky Lane, two grandsons and a granddaughter, and four great-grandchildren, as well as a great-great-grandson. A remembrance will be held on December 13th at 11 a.m. at Sherwood Church of Christ. In lieu of flowers and to honor her life, memorials may be sent to Odessa Christian School. Irenio Madrid Gonzalez, 71, passed from this life on December 7th in Odessa. He was born on June 28, 1950, to Jose and Maria Gonzalez in Chihuahua, Mexico. Those left to cherish his memories are his beloved wife of 46 years, Guadalupe Gonzalez, sons Eddie Gonzalez and David Gonzalez, daughters Diana Gonzalez and Aaliyah Araguin and Joe, brothers Basiliso M. Gonzalez, Santos M. Gonzalez, and Jose D. Gonzalez, sisters Evangelina G. Ponce, Esther G. Villarreal, 11 grandchildren, one great-grandchild, and several family and friends. He is preceded in death by both parents and a brother, Manuel Gonzalez. A memorial service will be held Monday, December 13th at 10 a.m. in the 24-hour chapel at Acres West Funeral Chapel in Odessa. Condolences to the family may be made to acreswestfuneral.com. Larry Barrow, 70, of Odessa, died Wednesday, December 8th in Odessa. Graveside service is scheduled for 12 noon, December 14th, at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Dorothy Marie Rowe Hall, 77, of Odessa, died Wednesday, December 8th in Odessa. Chapel service is scheduled for 1 p.m. Monday, December 13th, at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Burial will follow at Odessa Garden 2 at Ector County Cemetery. Carrie Stanton is officiating. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. James Edward Jerkins, 74, of Odessa, died Monday, December 6th in Odessa. Services will be scheduled at a later date. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Michael Ray McAlpine, 68, of Odessa, died Thursday, December 2nd in Odessa. Memorial service is scheduled for 1 p.m. December 16th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Pastor Matt Wilson is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Abelardo Sainz Tarango, 71, of Odessa, died Thursday, December 9th in Odessa. Chapel service is scheduled for 6 p.m. Monday, December 13th, at Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory. Burial will follow 2 p.m. Tuesday, December 14th, in Van Horn Cemetery. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Daniel Villalobos, 62, of Fort Worth, died Wednesday, December 8th, in Odessa. Mass will be celebrated at 10 a.m.